I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Be honest, when was the last time you had a friendly heart-to-heart conversation with someone whose opinions contradict your own, whether about presidential politics or guns or abortion, religion, the environment, you know the list. It's not easy to do. We are pretty tribal about the people we spend time with. They tend to share our values and points of view, so we don't know a lot of people who think differently from us. We tend to avoid them unless we want to fight with them. We also live in increasingly polarized times, and that makes it tough to engage in a civil conversation on just about anything, and that is not good for our democracy. So today on Radio Times, how to navigate around our own biases and really listen to someone with whom we disagree. We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Emile Bruneau is a social and cognitive scientist. I'm going to do that again. Emile Bruneau, a social and cognitive scientist. He's a research associate and lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. Emile, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Danigal Young is associate professor of communication at the University of Delaware. She's also a researcher at the National Institute for Civil Discourse. And Danigal Young, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us, Kevin Arsenault, professor of political science at Temple University, where he's director of the Behavioral Foundation Lab. It's been a bunch of years. Kevin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me back.
I do want to open the lines, and that phone number you can call us is 1-888-477-9499. Where do I begin? There's so many places to begin this conversation. Well, let me begin with a kind of basic question. And we certainly have lived through turbulent times in this country, but it does feel as if there is a deep divide. The people are angry. They're accusatory. You're nodding your head, Donegal.
Well, I'm actually thinking about how the divides that have existed between us have always existed, and those sort of the need for group identity has always existed. But what I see has happened, because I think about things in terms of media effects and in terms of our communication technologies, is the way in which our media system has contributed to those divides, you know, by having fragmented media outlets where people can really, you don't just have to have friends who only believe what you believe. Now you can actually seek out news from sources that only tell you the story, tell you the narrative of the world that comports with your worldview. And we know that that over time pushes people farther and farther in the direction that they were already inclined to move in. And that has deleterious effects.
I'm curious, from your perspective, Kevin, as a professor of political science, then, just how much you think our politics, perhaps married with our media, has created this environment.
I think it's enormous. And what I would add to this is that that I see that the effects of our media is largely coming at the end. And what honestly happened is the two major political parties, the Democrats and Republicans, began to divide very sharp ideological ways, mostly on social issues, in the 70s and 80s. And as partisans of both parties followed suit, we saw the sort of discourse around politics become more shrill, fewer moderates in Congress, and then you get on top of that partisan news media. And then that allows people to basically continue that dynamic all the way to its end.
Do you think it's different under Obama than it is under Trump? Do you think there's any difference in terms of just the sort of rawness of feeling? Do you want to get in on this, Emil?
Well, the feelings might be different, but I think the psychological processes are very, very similar. And I think beyond media, even social media seems to be set up to optimize things like confirmation bias and fundamental attribution error, the tendency to think that somebody else's faults from the other group are because of who they are and your own faults are because of circumstance. And you heard a lot of this around the Access Hollywood tapes for Trump. Mm-hmm. For Trump supporters, that was just locker room talk. It was situational. And for Trump detractors, it was a reflection of his true identity. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, for Clinton, the any kind of the improprieties in the server For detractors, it was a reflection of who she really was. And for her supporters, it was just, you know, some odd circumstance. So this fundamental attribution error, you establish that between groups, and then the confirmation bias, you just pay attention to information that confirms that narrative.
But how do you get to that confirmation bias? I mean, how do you get to that point of view that reinforces the point of view that you have?
Well, two ways. One, one is you can search out the information sources that confirm what you already believe to be true. And there's a huge amount of content. If you look for, I have some family members who are anti-vaccine activists, and the sheer amount of material that they put out on social media is really astonishing. But the other thing that I think is more troubling is that confirmation bias also describes how we view the world. So we filter information. We critically and minutely evaluate any information that contradicts what we believe to be true. And if we find some tiny fault in it, then we discard it. Whereas information that confirms what we believe to be true, even though it has flaws, we just accept it uncritically. And so that processing, we think that we're naive realists. We think we see the world as it really is, but we just don't. That's not how our brain is set up to process information. It's not set up to be high fidelity.
What I hear you saying is that we are tribal and we all have our biases, whether we think we do or we don't.
And the way that I think about this is, you know, my students are often asking, like, how do we overcome these biases that we have? Can we overcome them? And we can, but it takes a whole lot of work, and it takes actual cognitive energy that we're not usually that interested in expelling, honestly. But the reason that it happens, this is how I think about it.
Sure.
If we are factually wrong about something, like thinking in terms of evolutionary psychology for a moment, if we are factually wrong about something, but we are part of a group of people, we will survive, right? But if we are correct about something, but we're completely alone, we'll probably die. So our bodies and our brains prioritize group identity, right? Like having that solidarity and that allegiance over any sense of need for accuracy, which makes sense.
It makes us feel we're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Even if what we believe is wrong, and we believe it with other people, and so we are not alone in the
exactly.
world, we will not die.
Yeah. Yep. Because the way that we evolve as a species is in groups. We don't actually just evolve as individuals floating through the universe. And so group allegiances are paramount.
You know, I was thinking as you were talking that what any one of us would say to someone online is probably different from what we might say to them in person.
I hope so.
I certainly hope so. And certainly online commentary, and we see a lot of it on the show, you can say anything because you're not standing in front of a person that you are accusing of X, Y, or Z. Do you want to speak to that, Kevin?
Yes. You know, it's interesting that there's been a little bit of work done, research done on how, you know, how can you get partisans to be a little more reflective, to sort of second guess their gut reactions and their tendencies to engage in these sorts of confirmation biases. And, you know, what's interesting is some research I've done suggests that that's a personality trait. Some people are more or less likely to do that. But there aren't that many people who want to do that. So that's a problem. So what's interesting is some research done by Samara Klar, a political scientist at Arizona State University, where she actually gets people, partisans, and face-to-face settings and have them talk about, you know, various issues. And what you find when that happens is when people are thrown together and they're face-to-face, the norms, the social norms of politeness and these sorts of things actually helps people lower the emotional way in which we tend to process information alone or outside of that you know, social setting. But, you know, it's increasingly rare that people
actually get together
exactly.
with someone who they don't agree with.
That's right.
Let me turn to you, Emil. You've talked about or probably written about perspective giving, perspective taking. What's the difference and how does that help our conversation?
Yeah, well, actually, one way that I think technology can really benefit this process is we it's hard to have face-to-face conversations with people, and maybe increasingly unlikely, but it's not so hard to have video conferences with people, and you can gain a lot of the benefits that you do with face-to-face if you're on a video chat. And so I've done some of this work. Most of my research is on intergroup conflict between partisans like Israelis and Palestinians, or refugees in Europe, Muslim refugees, and the host countries. What I've found with Israelis and Palestinians is that if I get them to communicate with each other over one of these video chats, that perspective taking can be beneficial, but only for members of the majority group, the ones who are in power. And for the members of the minority group, what opens them up to the other side is actually the opposite, is being given the opportunity to speak and be listened to. And the degree to which they open up depends upon how well they feel like they were listened to. And it's not how sympathetic they think the other side is, but how well they think the other side listened and understands their position.
So that they were heard. I mean, that's the operative word. And I mean, I think in certain situations, the hardest thing to do is to listen.
And I think we're terrible at this in our society right now.
I
think we have a very litigious society, and we have this very adversarial style where we're unwilling to give an inch on our side because we think that it'll make us weak. Right. And if we're unwilling to accept that the other side has any kind of reasonable position, then it's really difficult to move forward from there.
Do we also feel good when we're not just angry, but sort of energized and
there's arousal up. There. Arousal is sort of a generic experience that is valence, independent of valence, right? You can have arousal that is negative or positive, but it just, the cortisol is flowing. Mm-hmm. And I think that...
So you feel alive.
Alive, right? I mean, that's because you're probably in the face of either some kind of stimulus or threat, and that gets you jazzed. You know, I was just to build upon what Emil was saying, I was thinking about this with my kids. You know, my 12-year-old is a sixth grader, and he has to do a lot of essays that are persuasive essays. And I was thinking about how fundamentally different it would be if we raised our children not to be constantly trying to persuade people of their own opinion. But imagine if they had school assignments that were about trying to articulate why someone who thinks opposite of you might hold that view. Like, how fundamentally different would that be in terms of, like, exhibiting a value system that's not just about being right is what is rewarded, but being open and understanding is what is rewarded.
Go ahead, Kevin.
You know, in fact, there's some work to suggest that perspective taking does actually get people to do that exact sort of thing. And I think that Dana's absolutely right that if there's a solution to this problem, is getting people to take the perspective of another person by asking, what would it like to be in that person's shoes? Why are they making those decisions? And the reason isn't because there's something wrong with them. They're not smart enough or they're selfish or they're evil. The thing is, you have to be motivated to do that.
And you have to care enough.
Exactly.
Right?
And sure, we can put people in a lab, in a psychology lab, and make them do it. But I mean,
but if there were incentives built in,
you know what? Hold on to that question only because we have to take a very short break, and I already see lots of calls coming in, which is great. We're talking about how to talk with people with whom we disagree, how to really listen to them, how to figure out our own biases, and you can call our conversation or call into our conversation 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do join our conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about what it takes to have a civil conversation with someone with whom you disagree or we disagree. Our guests are Kevin Arsenault, professor of political science at Temple University, where he's director of the Behavioral Foundations Lab. Also with us is Danigal Young, and she's associate professor of communication at the University of Delaware, also researcher at the National Institute for Civil Discourse, and Emil Bruneau, social and cognitive scientist, a research associate and lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. You wanted to say something, Danigal, right before the break.
Well, just when Kevin was talking about people would need to want to engage in this perspective taking, and how do we do that? And I'm thinking about, you know, how do we create incentives or mechanisms to encourage them to get beyond this sort of I'm right and you're wrong? I've been so fascinated by the work that's come out of the Engaging News Project at the University of Texas at Austin that's run by Talia Stroud. And she has come up with these really creative but novel solutions that news producers can use. For example, if you think about the way that Facebook has a like button,
yes,
or you know, Twitter has a heart button, that encourages us to consistently reinforce our preferences based on valence, right? So her idea is, what if we had a respect button, mm-hmm, right? You don't have to like something, but you can respect it because it's grounded in good argument, it's civil, it's well articulated. Respect. You know, and when you actually implement those, you know, in a controlled setting, there are positive outcomes that result from that, mm-hmm, that reduce those tendencies to just constantly push yourself in the same direction that you were starting out in.
I wonder, Amiya, whether the idea of having a civil conversation seems like something boring, whether it has the kind of connotation of being boring. Boring. Nothing happens. It's not exciting. People share ideas. Ho-hum. Do you think there's some truth to that, first of all?
It certainly, all of these processes that we have baked into us, they make us feel good when we reject the other side's arguments. So in that case, I think it would be less boring and more maybe a little bit painful to engage in validating the other side's point of view. And I think that's the internal state that probably holds us back from doing it. It has less to do with boredom. I think, mm-hmm, it is a really arousing state. It's just, it's not often pleasant.
Because if you validate the other side, then maybe you have to question your own beliefs, yeah, I mean, or maybe even admit you were wrong about
something.
As
just one example, I'm a liberal. I'm a Trump detractor, but I have a lot of conservative friends online. And I remember during the primaries, someone sent around this 10-minute video that was clips of Donald Trump doing and saying really decent things for people. And it was really difficult for me to watch it. And it also is such a strong validation of confirmation bias, because I realized I had never seen a single one of those clips before,
right,
and none of my liberal friends had. So that's how filtered the information is, that we never see these things, and when we see them, it's you know, sometimes almost kind of emotionally painful to watch them.
Well, and that gets us to this discussion about this idea that we can't seem to agree on facts. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, I think that does drive people apart to some degree, but if we're only getting the facts that confirm our own biases or opinions, then we don't have all the facts.
Well, and I think that, you know, to be honest, to some extent, but certainly in politics, the facts don't really matter, you know, because there are often facts that one can't test anyway, you know, what's true, what's not true. So, you know, people hold facts as not a way to come to an answer, but simply as a way to validate the thing that they already want to believe. And what makes this so difficult, especially on social media, is even when we're confronted with things that we disagree with and they have strong arguments behind them, you know, as Emil is saying, we're built to sort of reject these things. And so even these notions of like, oh, let's just have liberals watch Fox News and conservatives watch MSNBC and our problem will be solved. No, our problem won't be solved, because it will still push them in the opposite directions, mm, because they'll be rejecting the things that they don't want to agree with.
So is it hopeless? Can we all get along?
I hope not.
But
I think that the greatest optimism I have is that overriding all of this in the human brain is this this remarkable flexibility, that we have been given this evolutionary legacy of parochialism, of in-group loyalty, but we also can override almost any unconscious process. You know, yogis with enough training can override regulation of their body temperature. And if you can override something like that, that you should have no right to ever gain conscious control over, then you should have the ability to override some of these processes that we have going.
But then you have to want to do it. I mean, that seems to me part of the motivator, right?
Well, you have to want to do it, or you have to feel that there's some incentive. I mean, I have been in some way more optimistic as a result of these pushes for you know, country over party. You know, there's a push, like Matthew Dowd, the former Republican strategist, is pushing this country over party initiative. And it does feel like if we could somehow find a way to change our group identity instead of being in a tribe that's dictated either by party or by the candidate that we select. But what if we, because I always think about this, right, in terms of politics, what if we think of ourselves as dedicated to the principles of democracy? Like, that's our, what if that's our group identity? And just to build on a couple of things, one, with regards to, is civility boring? Unfortunately, you know, some research that's been done by Diana Motz at the University of Pennsylvania has found that, yeah, when you actually produce a news program like Crossfire that has the close-in camera angles and people are fighting and they're screaming and interrupting, attention and interest go sky high. What gets depressed is trust in government. And what else gets depressed is the ability of the viewer to cognitively process, interestingly, what the person of the opposing party is saying. So this is where, once again, we have tensions between the economics of media, which are about interest, attention, stimulation, and ratings, and the interest of democracy, which might not be as thrilling, but is fundamentally important.
Won't argue with that. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from a tweet from ATP. I stopped talking to conservatives when all they did was regurgitate Ailes, Fox News, conspiracy theories, and outright lies. Tweet from False Sapphire. I eagerly embrace and openly acknowledge my tribalism to support members and to criticize if need be. A tweet from Catherine. Passionately with family and friends, we talk politics. Passionately, some of us talk daily. Purposefully, we discuss a variety of issues. I mean, there are people who I'm sort of part of a family that likes to argue about a lot of things. And so, you know, we have oftentimes really deep and passionate discussions. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Let me get some callers in on the conversation. And it looks like we have Kristen calling us from Norristown. Hi, Kristen. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
You're so welcome.
My husband and I have always been politically opposite, and it's only from the last year when this election came up that we realized how completely polar opposite we are. And we were having some pretty heated debates, so much so that we're now in couples therapy because we cannot discuss politics without it becoming a complete raging fight. We also have an 8-year-old daughter who has been very troubled by the fact that mom and dad are on opposite ends of the spectrum, and we want to make sure that she's aware that it's just politics and we want to get along. So my question is, we've been married for 11 years and we've never discussed politics because it is such a hot button. Right. And this last year I've been very active going to marches and things. Is it better to just, we've survived 11 years with just putting it under the rug and not discussing it, or is it better to open up the big old can of worms and really hash this out, because it almost inevitably ends up in a raging fight?
Sure, Chris. I mean, such an important question. I'm hoping you have put that to your therapist, who knows you and your husband certainly better than we do. But I think it is a larger discussion. Perhaps I can start with you, Kevin, about just people that we love, we care about, they're close to us. Do you just sort of avoid things in order to keep the waters calm, or jump in, dig in, and fight it out?
Well, I think what's important is, As these tweets suggested, people sort of vary in the degree to which they are open and enjoy conflict. And I think that if you don't, engaging with that with a family member or somebody you care about makes it even more, I think, emotionally debilitating. Mm-hmm. What I think is important in all of this is that, avoiding talking about things that are hurtful, I think can sometimes be the right thing to do, but not always. And certainly, in this instance, in a marriage, sometimes you have to navigate one's differences. What I think would be important is if there's a way to maintain respect when doing this. And I think it's very crucial that when having a conversation with somebody that you disagree with, and it's very easy to do this, especially when it comes to politics, because these are questions that are very central about who a person is, to not leap to the notion that that person is essentially a bad person. And one doesn't want to think that about their spouse. And yet I think these kinds of conversations sure. push us in that direction.
Emil, you want to weigh in on this as well? I'm thinking about, I mean, some couples, individuals, they do like to argue about things, and conflict is not necessarily a problem. But I'm also thinking about, so the, what are the right questions to ask in order to understand someone's point of view that seems so diametrically opposed to one's own?
Well, I like the way you phrase it, the right questions to ask. I think that's the thing that we often lose track of, is we're so concerned with imposing our perspective on others that we lose track of trying to really understand where they're coming from. And like I said, it's a difficult process. It's it can be somewhat emotionally painful to understand where someone's views are, and that's a biological process. That is how our brains work. So that's not something that's deviant. That's something that's totally normal. And so I think engaging in that process and kind of embracing the discomfort is one of the ways that you can move forward.
And what, I mean, I'm thinking about those kinds of questions, which is, why do you feel this way? What, you know, why, I guess.
Yeah, you know, my experience is, especially talking with my conservative friends online, I find that if we get to what the heart of the issue is, because usually there's a fundamental principle that's at play. There's, you know, they might be opposed to refugees, Muslim refugees coming into the U.S. because they have deep concern for their family members. And that's a position that I can respect. And I feel like once you're there, then you can start slowly moving forward from that position to understand where the differences are.
Nandu, you want to add to that?
Well, a couple things. One, sort of looking from 30,000 feet, I think that we're in a particularly interesting moment for a lot of marriages where you have women and men who see things differently politically. We know that women are traditionally more averse to conflict than men, and yet we are in a political climate where issues that are salient to women are especially salient, and as a result of things that happened during the election campaign. So you have a lot of women who are starting to weigh in and become more politically active. So that does not surprise me. At the level of, like, how do you solve this, I'm thinking about the relationship that I have with my sister, who I love so much, and she and I are very different politically. But what I've come to understand is that I can respect that she engages actively in politics. She has a commitment to country and a commitment to democratic values. She enacts those differently. She has sort of different belief systems. But I love that mm-hmm. she is active and she's working for things that she believes in, and I tell her that. And when she lets me know that she's taking action on this or that, I tell her how proud I am that she values her community and she's working to these ends. And that has increased our ability to respect one another, even though our views are different.
Yeah. So she's not wrong.
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, she's not in what she wants, which, but it might be, I don't know what it is, but yeah. it might be very different from what you
exactly.
want.
And as Emil said, for one of the issues, she's up in New Hampshire, and one of the issues is wind turbines, which are very much not. She's not a fan,
gotcha.
For no pun intended.
I didn't go there quite
okay.
as quickly as you did.
But the reasons why are quite interesting, and they have to do with things about how she values her community, and she feels as though the local governments haven't been consulted enough by these international corporations. So once you actually get to the heart of it, it's like, yeah. I respect your view on this.
Yeah.
I don't end up in the same place. But then that actually solidifies our relationship.
Kristen, thanks for the call. Let's see what Kathy from New Jersey has to say. And Kathy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I originally called to say I grew up in a family with, there's four sisters, and we think so differently, and yet we're part of the basic family tribe, so to speak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That issue. But I would say that when I approach a sister with differing views, rather than get stuck in the differences in the Democratic and Republican Party, I speak to the human side of us and say, aren't you glad that you can go to a doctor when you're sick? Don't you wish that for everyone? And then we start thinking rather than taking, you know, positions.
Kathy, that's really interesting. I mean, in a sense, personalizing things, I'm assuming you're talking about healthcare. I mean, as a way, yeah. I guess, Kevin, to personalize an issue rather than just completely politicize it.
I think what this right. comment helps us see is that...
Thanks for calling, Kathy.
If people can be motivated to be reflective, to get past their gut reaction, and I think this is how the brain is built, that we tend to, you know, process things offline without conscious thought. And once it gets to conscious thought, we already have a position that we want to arrive at. And in politics, that's our tribe, our party tribe being right. And so I think a lot of these conversations boil down to position taking, as Kathy put it. Yeah. I think we can break past that, but we have to use the thinking part of our brain to second guess ourselves. And that's difficult.
It sure is. Emil, you did some interesting research, or I guess a study of Democrats and Republicans, having them look at that descent of man, Darwin's, I guess it's ascent of man, not descent of man, ascent of man.
That's a Freudian slip.
Yeah, exactly. Where he starts, you know, kind of hunched over, rather monkey-like, and then becomes Homo sapien. What did you find when you asked Democrats and Republicans to put each other on Darwin's ascent of man?
Yeah, well, this paints maybe an even bleaker picture, right? That we've been using this measure of a blatant dehumanization, and the measure that we came up with was something as overt and offensive as we could possibly imagine, which was, yes, placing people on the ascent of man diagram.
About evolution, right?
Yeah, and we've used this a lot in group conflicts. How do Israelis and Palestinians think about each other? How do Europeans think about Muslim immigrants? And the degree of dehumanization on this scale is pretty high in those contexts, and the degree to which individuals place people lower on that scale is a strong predictor of how many refugees mm. they think should be accepted into their country, for example. And what we found is that that American Democrats and Republicans actually dehumanize each other an equal amount, and the degree to which Democrats and Republicans dehumanize each other is greater than the degree to which Americans dehumanize Muslims. So it's one of the highest levels.
I mean, that's recent
yeah,
study.
Yeah, that's a very recent study. This is a longitudinal study over the last 6 months. So we've been looking at Democrats and Republicans over the course of the election.
Well, hold on to that thought. Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about how to have a conversation with someone with whom you disagree. Talking with Emil Bruneau, Donegal Young, and Kevin Arsenault. And again, you can join our conversation. I see a lot of people do. Call us 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me read a bunch of tweets here, and I know we want to pick up on something, Emil, you said right before our break, a tweet from Lewis. Really enjoying this conversation. I teach people how to identify bias and look for the confirmation bias and the negative biases, et cetera, here in Philadelphia. An email from Jim. I'm afraid I see the current polarization in terms that make a combination problematic. Let me put it this way. Why should I bother giving flat earther types their conspiracy equivalents serious consideration? So, I mean, this all fits really perfectly into our conversation. Donegal, you wanted to talk about this ascent of man study.
Yeah, well, so the notion that these effects are symmetrical, right, that both Democrats and Republicans are engaging in this dehumanization, I think this is really important because especially on the left, which is where my circles are, right? I'm in academia, and we are very much on the left, and we tend to think, okay, well, we have a respect for scientific inquiry and for verifiable facts, so therefore we are correct, and the way that we view the world is correct. We like to think that that is what is driving how we see the world, but the reality is that then also becomes a group identity and a social cue. I was thinking about this with the March for Science, and I saw people having T-shirts that said, "Got science?" question mark. That's a social cue. Mm. That's not about how you view the world as much as a statement of who you are. Or people who have the little Darwin fish on the back of their car with the legs, right? It's as a cue, I am in this group. I am someone who believes this thing, but it's more about who I am as a person. So just to remind folks on both sides, you are every one of us is engaging in these sort of tribal relationships and these tribal identities.
But are you saying that tribal identity is more important to us than the facts that we espouse?
Yes, I think that even for people who are thinking of themselves as those driven by scientific inquiry, I think even that mm-hmm. then becomes a badge and an identity. And I would really challenge, you know, my friends on the left to think about mm-hmm. that and take a moment, because I do think that permeates the conversation.
Kevin, you want to add something? We were talking during the break.
Yes. I just want to underscore exactly what Dana just explained, which is that even folks on the left who think that, you know, science drives the decisions they make, if you put them – if you give them scientific facts with which they disagree, they behave in the same fashion that any other motivated reasoner does. Mm-hmm. They discount them and they keep the things that they want to believe. So, you know, I think what's important in all of this in this conversation is to recognize that all of us have biases. And then the second thing is the tweet that you read a second ago. I think mm-hmm. that what happens in this discussion a lot is we degrade the other side's positions to, you know, everybody I disagree with is a flat earther, but that's not the case. I mean, the people who are flat earthers are a very, very small percent of this country, even if they have a lot of presence on the web. But most of the disagreements that we have with people that we care about are about fundamental questions about what's fair, what's not fair, what's a threat, what's not a threat, mm-hmm. and we just have reasonable disagreements about those questions.
But Emil, are the three of you saying that there are no facts, or that when it comes to discussing things with people with whom we disagree, arguing the facts is not going to get you anywhere?
Well,
or something else.
So, well, the first point I think is that the deep frustration I think the scientific community feels is that science has become a partisan issue, right? This is something that a lot of people are really frustrated with, is, you know, that climate denial is Republican Party has embraced this, and they're the only major party in the world that's embraced it. So this is a big outlier here. And so scientific inquiry has mysteriously become this wedge issue, mm-hmm. This partisan issue. And that's the tragic part. But about avoiding facts, I don't think that's the case at all. And in fact, I think there's some really promising research showing that sometimes revealing some of these unconscious associations or biases that we have can inoculate you against experiencing them, right? That we have this remarkable flexibility. And if you bring some of these unconscious processes into the light of day, that people can decrease them. So I've been working, for example, on the tendency for Americans to collectively blame Muslims for a terror attack, right? Blame all of Muslims for an individual terror attack. And if I take them first through a little activity where I ask them to report how responsible they think they are for Anders Breivik or Dylann Roof or Wade Page, white supremacists who have made these attacks, and how responsible they think the white community is, they generally report very low on the scale. And then when I ask them how responsible are individual Muslims and Muslims in general for terror attacks, they're very low on this scale. And it has an effect on how they vote on their willingness to sign petitions. So it has an actual effect on behavior. So that, to me, is a 30-second intervention that might dramatically change someone's view about another group just by revealing one of these unconscious biases. And there are a number of different biases that this has been applied to successfully. Some of them are much more difficult to change, but some of them we can.
And it's by gently pointing out, I mean, saying, did you or have you or will you, something like that?
Yeah, well, I think the gentle part is key, because if you say you're an idiot and you're a hypocrite, then you'll have other kind of self-defensive biases coming online, and that'll actually make people more entrenched in their views. So, yeah, it's part of how you do it.
Let me see what Tim from Philadelphia has to say. And, Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I'm a huge fan of Carl Jung, and I was heartened to hear your one guest bring up the issue of the role of the subconscious in forming our beliefs. But and while I see his point about like yogis and maybe martial artists,
right,
to alter, what it sounded like he meant, like the autonomic or involuntary physiological mechanisms. But I think it would just take tremendous effort to do this, and it just doesn't seem realistic that the general population is going to be. Doesn't government need to govern more, operate more on probabilities than hoping, or against human nature?
Well, you know, Tim, your phone is not the greatest, so let me just take a couple of points that you had to make, and I think the main one is. You have to want to do this. I mean, we're talking about the importance of doing this, the importance of having a civilized conversation with someone. But as we've said several times, Kevin, you have to want to do this.
Yeah, I mean,
it has to somehow matter.
At the base of this is motivation, right? And this is what I think psychologists have been telling us for the past 20 years, is that people have to be motivated to want to do things with which they have a predisposition to not do. And so, if the question is how do we get our politics in a different place, I think it is true that we can't just start with what individuals should be doing, but also be thinking about, you know, how can political discourse be structured differently. You know, this is always going to take you to a place of maybe having some unrealistic set of discussions, but I think that it's better to have those discussions than to throw our hands up.
And throw our hands up. Yeah,
I do think that it's possible. You know, even on a college campus where the students are predominantly left-leaning, to talk to them about the fact that democracy fails. Democracy simply cannot function if you are going to stay entrenched over here and you're not going to reach out, you're not going to try to empathize with the other side. You know, the idea that the system completely depends on our willingness to engage in this as a society. And then I think they start, you know, valuing this notion that there's something bigger than just myself and my own view. But it requires, I think, that set of values be, you know, reinforced and reactivated over and over, that, like, there is something bigger than just your opinions. And it's the system, and it's the norms and the processes.
Emil, is it important to empathize with a terrorist? I mean, there was a terrorist attack in Manchester, England, yesterday very early this morning. I mean, certainly you mentioned college campuses, and a lot of them, they don't want to hear from conservatives. They don't want to hear, or they don't want to hear from white supremacists. I mean, should we be open to any and all perspectives?
Well, I guess first, just a point on what we were just talking about is some of these things, as I mentioned, can potentially be easy to reveal some of these unconscious processes. Others take a lot of effort, but I think we're committed to that. We have an educational system. We teach people about democracy isn't a natural state of human existence, and civil discourse isn't a natural state, but we've committed to this in our educational system to train people to learn how to do this. It's just that we don't prioritize it enough, I think, in older years, and we don't teach people, for example, how to listen. And I think this could be a skill. Again, it's not something that necessarily comes easily or naturally, but it's something that we can teach. And I think it is important to try to extend your empathy as far as it can go, even if it means trying to understand the motivations of a terrorist. And I think the people who do this only benefit from understanding the other side's view. Think of Nelson Mandela, for example, right? Like, he was imprisoned on Robben Island, and over that time, he decided to try to understand the perspective of his white captors under apartheid. And I think that really benefited him when he was finally released to navigate South Africa into a peaceful transition away from apartheid. So I don't think that we should think of empathizing even with our deepest enemy as something that that is unpatriotic or forbidden. I think it's something that is an important exercise, and doesn't make us weak. It just means that we're doing something that's hard to do, which in my book means that it's strong.
How do you turn off the conversation you're having with yourself when listening to somebody else?
Well, I think so. Buddhism, I think, has the greatest playbook for us, right? They've basically been applied cognitive scientists for 2,500 years. So they've been doing this a lot longer than we have. And their process is to first recognize what's going on in your mind. So consciously recognize those unconscious processes. And once you're able to consciously recognize them, then you have the opportunity to change them. And I think that's a playbook for how we can move forward. And this is how cognitive behavioral therapy works. So we're integrating some of this into our modern society and our modern training. I just think that, you know, we know what to do. It just is a matter of kind of pedagogically making it happen.
Well, Danigal, I know that you act and you've been on the show before talking about improv and satire and comedy, but I'm also thinking about how acting, being another person, playing another role, another part, is in part an act of empathy, an act of understanding.
I think that that's something that is a real gift of being able to perform and adopt these different characters. And I know we talked about this before the show, but, you know, when I do improv with Comedy Sports and we get a suggestion from the audience, our whole brand is supposed to be for everyone, comedy for everyone, all ages, you know, the older people and kids. And what that means is that when you get a suggestion that is really politically loaded, right, you get a suggestion of Donald Trump, you play Donald Trump, and you play Donald Trump with dignity. And when you get a suggestion of, okay, you are a 7-Eleven clerk, you play that 7-Eleven clerk and you do it with dignity. And the comedy doesn't come from mocking the person you're playing. The comedy comes from the situations that this person happens to get into and the relationships that they develop. And that's really a wonderful thing, to constantly be able to find the dignity and the empathy for the different people that you're playing.
Interesting. I'd love to ask you about Alec Baldwin, but we'll save that for another day. Let me get Kevin from Warminster to join our conversation. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Yes?
Hello. Thank
Hi there.
You.
Sure.
I'm very interested in this conversation. But
thanks.
It seems that only the left would be talking this way. I don't think right-wing radio stations, conservative radio stations, are talking about how do we get along with the left. I just don't see that happening at all. Like, it's just muted. In fact, if I listen to other radio talk shows, they actually cut off people as soon as they start talking leftist or whatever, or, you know, liberal.
Well, you know what, Kevin? Let me toss your question to Kevin Arsenault here, and also just to say that, you know, we welcome all comers, frankly, I think.
The left does that. I don't think the right does.
Yeah, well,
because just being liberal means that you do open your mind to others.
Well, that's interesting. Let me give Kevin Arsenault a chance to respond. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, you know, I think that we have to separate a couple of things, which is that media on the right is a particular brand of media. And I wouldn't want to paint all conservatives with that brush, right? So that's a way in which conservative TV radio shows especially kind of get viewership by having this kind of blood sport. And in particular, every day, this is why liberals are idiots. But you know, I've had plenty of conversations with conservatives who don't approach it that way. Now, it is true that openness to experience is one of the things that correlates with liberalism, but that tends to be an openness to wanting to, try interesting foods, go to interesting locations, and an intellectual curiosity. But what we find over and over again is that, you know, once liberals have an opinion, they want to cling to that opinion, just like conservatives do. So I think we have to sort of separate out these sorts of things, because it makes me worried when I hear liberals say, "Oh, well, our side is smarter than the other side," because that's not going to help us get out of this issue. If we're the smart ones, the liberals, then why should we listen to the conservatives? The conservatives, on the other hand, they might have something valuable to tell us.
We're going to end on that note, although we could go on and on and on and on. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Kevin Arsenault, thanks a lot. And he's professor of political science at Temple University, where he's director of the Behavioral Foundations Lab. Danigal Young, thank you for joining us as well. And she is associate professor of communication at the University of Delaware and a researcher at the National Institute for Civil Discourse. Emile Bruneau, thank you for coming in. And he's a social and cognitive science, a scientist, a research associate and lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. And looks like our listeners could have carried on this conversation as well. Thanks for all those comments and calls. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.